Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want. Vanity Fair.
Well, Tom, this is a strange end, isn't it?
End?
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching, a television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Hilary Busis.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss the final four episodes of Netflix Ripley.
Roma, Imola, Palermo, Livorno, Empoli, Ypsilon.
Later on, Andrew Scott, the talented Mr. Ripley himself, is going to be stopping by to tell us all of his deep, dark secrets.
This recap is going to cover episodes 5 through 8. So if you haven't finished watching Ripley, be warned, spoilers abound.
Speaking of spoilers, let's do a quick rundown of what happened in the last 4 episodes of Ripley. We start episode 5 with an unexpected visitor. Freddie Miles finds Tom in Rome.
So how'd you know he was here?
The phone. See, it's not in any phone book yet, but I called the phone company. They had the address.
Freddie says he's going to the police, and Tom opts to kill him, as Tom does. Tom drops Freddie's body off on a road outside Rome, and then Tom, as Dickie, is questioned by police.
How do I put this? Freddie sometimes had relations with strangers.
Strangers?
That he would meet at a club or on the street.
Woman, do you mean, or man?
Man.
But soon, the police and the press link the murder of Freddie Miles to the abandoned boat covered in blood, and Tom is at the center of it all.
Someone is dead in Rome. Someone may be dead in Sanremo, killed in a boat that is sunk to try to hide blood stains. And Signor Ripley is missing. This is the situation.
Tom starts a new life in Venice and helps plant seeds that Dickie killed himself on a ferry to Tunisia. The police buy the story, so does Mr. Greenleaf, and even Marge after a farewell letter turns up.
To be honest, I feel kind of lost. I know the reasons, but I won't burden you with them, except to say that I have some deep regrets about some things that have happened. Some things I've done.
But that ending comes into question as Marge publishes her book, and finally a photo of the real Richard Greenleaf is published.
Tom. Please, Tom.
Okay, so I think that there was a missed opportunity in the back half of this season. I think that one of these episodes could have been called That Darn Cat.
I wrote that down.
Because Lucio the cat knows everything.
Mm-hmm. And got blamed.
That Tom has done.
For the blood splatter.
That was, I know, got blamed for the dirt, yeah.
For the dirt, really.
I mean, it's funny how when this story is stretched into series form, they had to be like, a lot of this is luck. You know, like, no one can perfectly get away with everything. And that the fact that the landlady was like, oh, he's catching mice again. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, whew, you know, but like that, he couldn't plan for that.
Well, it's just so wild. And I guess, like, dramatically, I think it works. But it is so wild that the entire investigation hinges on Ravini never seeing a picture of Dickie Greenleaf.
Until the last frame. That was crazy.
Which is a great stroke of luck.
A great stroke of luck. And then you also...
It worked for me. It's like a nice Usual Suspects moment at that very end when he's putting the book down.
And it's a period piece. It's like, okay, it's the 50s. You're not... You know, that it makes sense that he might not be able to see...
Yeah, the different precincts in Italy aren't really communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. Like, there's
one doesn't want to
do
his job. One detective, you know.
Yeah. You'd have to imagine that the newspapers would be running photos
one
of these
photo.
People, though, right?
One photo of Dickie Greenleaf would have...
I guess it was harder to get them. I mean, if like, Marge didn't give them one.
Yeah, that's fair. Maybe this, like, rich, powerful family didn't want photos of him out there. Okay, so speaking of, like, appearances and Ravini never, until the very end, did we buy the whole Venice scene where he dims the lights and puts on a beard and a wig.
Wait, he did Tom Ripley drag? The Tom Ripley drag scene.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I at first
was like Abraham Lincoln drag.
Yeah. I was at first like, oh, brother, but like, I don't know, maybe it just got over the line of believability for me.
What I didn't understand was why Andrew Scott wasn't doing a different voice.
That was also kind of crazy to me, too, because I was like, you sound so much. You've established that you're a Dickie Greenleaf, and you talk like this, and now you basically have a beard and a wig, and you're talking the exact same way as Tom Ripley, which, again, I guess I credit a lot of it to it's the 50s, who's to say, maybe that disguise would really work. But I was like, if he just did like a little bit of an accent, but maybe then I would have been like, okay, this is a huge joke. Maybe if he had laid it on thick.
It just would have seemed too silly.
It would have seemed too silly, I think.
I kind of thought, because in the film version, Ripley hears that the inspector is going to come to Venice and he's like, uh-oh. And then the inspector walks in and it's a different guy because the original inspector has been fired. And so again, luck. And so I kind of expected this show, which is, it's not trying to be sensational. It's low to the ground, whatever. Although it does have a sense of humor to it. I thought they were going to have another thing like that. But when I realized, oh, no, it's the same inspector who's going to show up and talk to him. I feel like that's the craziest thing this whole series does, is that scene in a way for me.
You're right. I mean, and it's funny, too. The movie, I guess we shouldn't keep comparing them, but it's really
We kind of have to.
It's difficult not to, right? In the movie, Tom also winds up, Matt Damon's Tom, winds up getting off because of blind luck. Like, the Greenleaf family, it turns out that they've been covering up a bunch of stuff from Dickie's past that they don't want out. They decide, we are going to just sweep everything under the rug. We're going to assume that he's dead. We're going to assume that he did these terrible things. Like, you're off the hook. Goodbye. And that is also a big deus ex machina.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Dickie ex machina. I mean, I think I would qualify that by saying the extraordinary good luck of the patriarchy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of people who are able to afford to make luck,
will keep women out of certain business and be like, well, a fella's going to have a girl on the side or whatever, whatever the sort of assumptions are in both versions of this story. Like, there is, I mean, you could kind of imagine Highsmith, smuggling in some sort of like comment on like what men are allowed to get away with because men help each other out.
Yeah, like Tom Ripley cannot get away with the things that quote unquote Dickie Greenleaf can.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, there's that too. Yeah. So I don't know. I think the film has such a sort of shattering emotional conclusion, and this is more just like he got away with it. And I think that in that sense, in the show, because they also change how Marge feels about everything at the end. Like, she's like, the big ring scene happens, and in a movie, that's a huge turning point for Marge. But in this, closer to the original, like, she's like, oh, so that does mean he killed himself, And that made me feel so much, because at least the movie gives Margie the final, like, I know it was you, and she hits him and then gets dragged off.
And gets dragged off.
But I think, honestly, I kind of read that scene, though, as maybe Marge is smarter than Tom is giving her credit for, or than we as the audience are giving her credit for. Like, I think that you can watch it and think, like, oh, she is also acting. She realizes that this isn't right. She doesn't want Ripley to kill her.
Yeah.
There's not going to be somebody walking in at the last minute to save her, so she is going to take the temperature down. Like, you saw her at that party. Yeah. She is not so different from Tom, as Dakota Fanning
said to
Chris. Like, she wants to be somebody important. She is going to find a way to kind of turn this situation to her advantage as, the poor, grief-stricken partner of this guy who died in a violent way.
Well, she has a lot to lose now, too. Her books, she's got these book deals coming. She's enjoying the attention that she's getting. She's reveling in the moment a little bit, as sick and twisted as that might be. But as Dakota said, like, she's enjoying the vanity that's coming with...
So you can assume that maybe she realizes what's happening. She's quick enough to put together what might happen to her if she can't change her tune. And then she finds a way to... save herself.
Yeah,
that's true.
Maybe that's
a little generous.
Maybe
he's a little generous.
Too much credit, but
no. I mean, I think there's definitely something there, and I think it also then it further complicates the portrait of Marge as someone maybe complicit in this darkness, and kind of almost accepting that like the way that Ripley moves through the world is sort of unavoidable, and so I might as well not get sucked under.
Totally, if you can't beat them, join them. Yeah,
right, join them, or at least let them get away with it.
Tolerate them, exactly.
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting point. And I was also kind of struck by the end because, you know, we knew he was going to get away with it, but how exactly that was going to happen, and the flashbacks to Caravaggio and that murder and whatnot, this sort of idea, to quote another musical, of, you know, who says that murder isn't an art? That it's not, like, it took some artfulness and some, you know, grace and a lot of luck for Tom Ripley to get away with this. And I don't know, the idea of him, that last shot of him sitting, sipping his wine, looking at the Picasso, and then we flash back to Caravaggio looking at the painting covered in blood, and mm-hmm. this idea of, you know, violence and art and getting away with something, I thought that was kind of compelling and a nice sort of substitute for a big emotional mm-hmm. climax that we were never going to get, because that's not what the show was about. But this idea of, oh, wow, it does take some... It's bad, but it takes some sort of skill mm-hmm. and artfulness in order to do what Tom Ripley has done.
Yeah, I agree. I thought that the Caravaggio stuff could have easily been heavy-handed and seemed forced, but it worked for me.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Caravaggio was another dark and very complicated gay guy, so... Yeah.
Who made beautiful things.
Yeah.
There is such a shortage of these figures in art history and culture more broadly.
Yeah. I think that bringing in that sort of artistic illusion, I think, was maybe at that point necessary for this take on the material, because, like, as beautiful as the black and white photography is, like, it is chilly, mm-hmm. you know, and I think to sort of introduce something almost operatic, or sort of, like, the idea of this kind of echo through time of, like, this, that I'm glad that Zalian, like, raise this sort of metaphorical stakes or whatever, mm-hmm. Just for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, in a more literal sense, we get to see some of Tom's art. I think it is no accident that he's a better painter than Dickie.
Of course he is, because he's actually good at stuff, and he's smart, and he
sees the world.
Yeah. He's capable of learning. And, I mean, and that speaks to, like, this version of Ripley, too, which is not even necessarily that he envies Dickie, but he's just like, I could be Dickie better if I had the same leg up that you had, like, I could live the good life. I could decorate an apartment better than him. Like, I can paint better than him. Like, I can make cocktail conversation better than him. Yeah. Like, I should be him, but not him. I should be in his position.
Right. I could out-Dickie if I had the opportunity. But there was also, we sort of saw the flip side when he's at that party and he's hanging out with all these rich people. He's living the life that he fantasized about and he worked so hard to get. And he's like, in part because the people were not being that nice to him. They were like, maybe you murdered him. But he was like, Marge, let's go. Like, these people are exploiting Dickie and, you know, and exploiting his, they're bored and they have nothing to do but talk about other things. So it's kind of interesting to see him get somewhat disillusioned with the things that he, that he wanted.
Hypothetically, if someone were to work at a magazine for a decade, and the magazine is sort of trades, like, they write a lot about, like, rich and famous people.
Let's call it Bonfire.
And, yeah. Right, and one were to start meeting some of those people over the years and attending parties that they were at, one could get disillusioned when realizing a lot of these people are vapid and cruel.
Oh, wow, that's okay.
Not all, by any means.
Not all, never.
But no, you're right, and I also think that I like that they were careful to point out that, like, in a lot of material ways, Dickie, or Tom, rather, is better at this mm-hmm. than Dickie was. But he does make, okay, little bathrobe faux pas.
Yeah.
Shouldn't have been Paisley. but then he replaces it.
And he learns from his mistakes.
He's learning. And he has a weird fixation on big glass ashtrays, but, like, they're kind of chic.
They are chic. They're gorgeous and good for murder. I do think something that we not discounted, but that did bubble up to the surface again, was whether or not Tom, like, was actually in love with Dickie and how that sort of manifested. And he definitely was frustrated. It's definitely not the same love that transpired in the 1999 film, but we did see in that big sort of last showdown with Tom and the private investigator from New York that he, in his mind, he concocted the story that, which worked to his benefit, but also you could feel that Tom wanted Dickie to be in love with him.
Oh, fully,
a weird, sick, twisted way, and it's in a way that isn't, you know, explicitly gay, but definitely queer and definitely complicated and definitely, I would say, in Tom's case, a symptom of his mental illness, sociopathy, that he concocted this fake relationship and this admission of love to from Dickie to Tom. One, in order to get away with murder, but also he kind of wanted Dickie to fall in love with him, too. It felt like. That's what I got from that.
Well, and not because Ripley loved Dickie, but just to better take advantage of him, I guess.
Mm.
Maybe.
Well, I think that's up for debate. Like, I mean, yes, I think the love that Ripley had for Dickie definitely is not as emotional and pure as, you know, the Matt Damon to Jude Law love. But I don't know. I think I found myself, that's where I found the most humanity and sort of felt like, oh, bad for Ripley. Mm-hmm. Being like, oh, at the end of the day, he really did kind of want Dickie to sort of be as enamored with him as Ripley was with Dickie. Wow, it's easy to confuse that. And that never happened. I think he was, you know, he was also frustrated, but he also thought Dickie was a dilettante and bad at stuff and whatnot. But there is that, there was an attraction there, I think.
What do we think this version of the story, like this version of Freddie Miles, what did Freddie see in Tom? Like what did Freddie detect? Because I think in the Philip Seymour Hoffman portrayal of the character, it's really, it's kind of a class disgust, you know, and a little bit of homo, you know, or a lot of homophobia.
Do you think that the Philip Seymour Hoffman Freddie is not gay?
I kind of think that he's
a fancy man,
like a sort of satyr.
He's just,
I think
like a fop?
He just like,
yeah,
I think he just like sleeps a lot of people, but okay. but Tom is sort of reveals it too readily and in the wrong ways.
Well, or that he's like too feminized.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, there are certainly gay guys even today who are like, I don't like drag queens, you know, whatever. Yeah. But in this version, I thought, you know, everything leading up to Freddie's murder is pretty arresting. But I don't know. I'm curious to hear what you two think about, like, is it the same thing where Freddie is just like this, like, grifting poor guy? Or, like, I don't know. It felt something different there.
I feel maybe not as far away from the film that there was definitely a class disgust or that Freddie instantly sniffed out that this guy is a striver. He's not one of us. It's an us versus them thing. And I think where the difference is, I didn't sense the homophobia apparent, because, mm-hmm. I mean, Freddie was sort of androgynous himself in a way in this version.
And is unambiguously queer.
Yeah.
We see a man in his bed, too.
So there was that element sort of faded away to me, and it was more you'll never be a part of this inner circle, and I can tell you, you're loafers. Yeah, like, you're lying about your shoes, you're lying about all of these things that, like, rich people know and get.
And thus was Freddie in love with
I
just don't know if we know Freddie.
Yeah, I don't know if we saw it. Did we see Freddie with Dickie that much?
I wanted like another scene.
Mm-hmm. Same. I think that's my one complaint about this versus the movie, is that in the handful of scenes and like the minutes of screen time that Philip Seymour Hoffman had, he just made such an impression, and his character was so immediately legible. And Elliot Sumner, I think, is very charismatic and has a face that the camera loves. Mm-hmm. But I just don't think that they got enough to do to really kind of turn Freddie into a character.
Because in the film, there's the boat scene.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I think we just needed one more bit of Freddie and particularly Tom interacting. Because the thing is, it's not just about the scene right when Freddie's murdered. It's then the whole rest of the story almost is people saying the term Freddie Miles like 48 times an episode. And you kind of, exactly. And you kind of need to, like, by no means have to like Freddie Miles, but you have to feel the weight of their absence, of his absence, you know? And I just, it's hard to do that when you haven't spent much time with him.
No, I agree. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that Ravini is a character in this in a way that, you know, the Italian police don't really get to be in the movie. And I thought that was an interesting choice and a fun choice.
I thought he had actors great. Mm-hmm. I mean, I said this in my review, but like, I have a slight sort of like something unsettled feeling about the way that the Italians are often used as comic relief, as little buttons in episodes, and, you know,
Enzo the dog, and the dog's name is the guy's name is Enzo,
the dog's name is Enzo.
I laughed. I think it's funny. It's just an interesting way to sort of frame the story, but I'm glad that they did. I mean, Ravini is making one huge dumb mistake, which
never
is
looking at a picture.
Can I see a photo of
one
this
photo?
But other than that, like, I like his sort of dogged, like, his politeness and also the weariness he shows, and increasingly more and more of this sort of, you know, the guy in Palermo, whatever, be like the police person being like, look, you American playboys, the law is at least somewhat subject to you. So you, when I say you have to come to the police station, I'm not asking you.
You like, show up.
That mounting frustration I thought was well done.
No, I think he reminded me a lot, maybe not accidentally, of the detective that John Turturro plays on The Night Of, which is also a Stephen Zalian production.
Precisely,
totally.
Yeah.
And which is worth revisiting, I think, just kind of this weariness, this sense of wanting justice, but just being so tired because it's just so difficult to mm-hmm. actually find.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think that I like that having the inspector character get so much screen time because, I mean, it makes what Ripley pulls off more impressive, yes, but also it kind of helps deepen the picture of, like, just bureaucratic sprawl mm-hmm. that someone could easily just disappear into. Yeah.
And makes a good parallel between the work that goes into actually getting away with a murder and the work that goes into investigating one. Because,
right.
you know, much like actual reporting, like, actual detective work is really hard and tedious mm-hmm. and difficult. And, like, watching it kind of play out slowly and gradually in the same way that we watch, you know, Tom in real time have to dispose of a body, I think, like, makes for an interesting parallel between the two.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Do we like having two long dispose of the body sequences?
I don't know if we necessarily needed to, but, I mean, it's very tense.
Yeah.
Like,
I would have, if they had to get rid of one, I would get rid of the boat.
I think
the elevator and all the noise it's making mm-hmm. and then the car, having to get him in the car. And I think, it was really suspenseful. Though there is good stuff in the boat. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like that is sort of the point of the Enterprise, is mm-hmm. to see the step-by-step process.
I mean, I love him getting back and just being like, oh, fuck, I left the wallet yeah, and I wanted it to look like a robbery. And then he has to go all the way back
and then back and forth on the crime scene. And oh, yeah. And I thought the hat was going to get him in the end.
And I'm stressed out. Like, how late is it? Like I, from personal experience, like, a lot of European towns shut down at, like, 9 p.m., and you're like, well, how is he getting these taxis? But, like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty compelling. And there's a comic lilt to it, you know, that I think as the series went on, especially in the back half of the episodes, I grew to appreciate.
Yeah. I will say, for all of that process and all of the steps, and then seeing Ravini take the steps in Atrani 2 and get tired and whatnot, and all of that process, it was kind of fun and kind of like, well, luck does happen at the end, like a Deus Ex Machina, when John Malkovich just shows up and is like, hey, I can just forge a passport and give you a new name.
we should talk about John Malkovich for a minute also, because the character that he's playing is a Highsmith character.
Okay, I didn't know that. Yeah. I was like, so he just meets this guy at a party, mm-hmm. can tell that he's kind of shady, and then boom, he's Timothy Fanshaw, and mm-hmm. we'll get away with it scot-free. It felt, again, a little convenient, but as we've said, you gotta get lucky if you're gonna get away with murder.
And once you reach this echelon of society, it's much easier to be lucky.
Yes, right. Absolutely, and to pay to be lucky. Yeah.
It's a cute bit of casting, too, because Malkovich has played Ripley, too, in another movie. It's like an older Ripley. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, it was interesting encountering that guy and be like, oh, so there's more of you out there. Like, yeah.
Before we leave Marge, what did you make of the scene where she's kind of right by the edge of the canal and he could very easily push her or not? I kind of read that as her daring him to,
tempting
but this
him.
Going back into my vision of Marge as like a shrewd operator.
Right,
I mean,
right.
Maybe that's giving her too much credit.
I thought she was a drunk girl.
Very, very fair. But I don't know. I kind of thought that maybe she had some suspicion at that point, kind of wanted to see what he would do if she was that close to falling in, like if he would take the bait, and then he winds up not. Which, I don't know, if I guess he is not always the most scrupulous, but I guess he must even realize, like, she'll be right there.
Right there. I sort of saw it less of a read of Marge and more of a read of, oh, Ripley really is a murderer and is someone who actually gets some sort of perverse... It's not just...
It's not a means to an end.
A means to an end. It's not.
Fun
it's something him. That's fun for him. It's not just to like raise his station in life. It's something that he got the sick pleasure of like murdering Marge right then and is fantasizing about it. But then because he literally has gotten away with so much and he can't take another body at this juncture, that's what keeps him from doing it. But it was a picture into his psyche of like, oh, he actually enjoys this.
Yeah, and then the sort of madness of the snowball rolling down the hill. It's like, well, I'll just kill another one. I keep getting away with it, you know. But then it's like, wait a second.
That's how
that
they
would
get
be,
you.
That would be, you know, don't be greedy.
Don't be greedy.
And then it turns out by the end that either Marge is kind of agrees to sort of tacitly go along with him or just gets really duped. And so he didn't need to do it at all.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe would we want to see more Highsmith in this Steve Zalian kind of mode?
I would. I will say, I know we've spoken at length about the aesthetics and about the vision here. did it grow a little bit tedious by the end, and there was sort of a 90-minute movie for the last episode. Right. I was a little bit, it grew a little weary to me. But ultimately, I really did enjoy the ride, and I really did enjoy, it felt like nothing else on television right now in a really exciting way. And the dedication and the deliberateness with which Zillion, you know, told the story and all the details and all the little stuff. I mean, Dakota Fanning said, like, a lot, you know, a lot of directors now are like, hey, we'll fix it in post. Like, it doesn't really matter. And that is not Zillion's way. Like, that watchful eye, I would definitely be interested in him taking on something else from this canon, another sort of fucked up serial killer person.
Yeah, not to belabor the metaphor too much, but, like, you can see that he has the same kind of meticulous eye as Ripley and is doing, like, the same amount of work and, you know, how careful everything is. And, yeah, I appreciate being able to see the effort. It doesn't feel, you know, it doesn't feel sweaty. It just feels, like, very thoughtful.
Yeah, which I think, just in general, I would like more of on television these days.
Yeah, so thoughtful television?
Yeah, no, it's you know, Netflix, I think, in so many cases is, like, what you have on while you're doing something else. But, like, you have to pay attention to this show, and that's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment when we return to conversation with Andrew Scott, who plays Tom Ripley.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect. Her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
Who is Tom Ripley? I think that's the big question that ends the series, right?
It does indeed. And Andrew Scott, who plays Ripley, is here to weigh in on just that.
Finally, answers.
And I got a chance to speak to Andrew Scott about playing Tom Ripley. Enjoy the conversation. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
I have to imagine stepping into the role of Tom Ripley, there's a lot of pressure that comes with that. How much did you refer to the 1999 version? Obviously, this Ripley is completely different.
Well, I didn't reference it really, apart from what I tried to do is to forget about it.
Yeah.
Because it's a film that I love. But I hadn't seen it in, oh my God, probably about 20 years. So I'm kind of glad. I was lucky in that sense. But it left an impression on me, but I'm glad that I haven't seen it in such a long time. And of course, one of my, you know, first questions was, you know, why do this? And Steve Zaillian, our writer director, was, you know, very clear about the kind of vision that he had for this version of the story. Mm. He had been very enamored by the book right from the get-go. When he read it many, many years ago, and he had this vision that he wanted. He didn't immediately say that he wanted to do it in black and white, but that sort of emerged, and he mentioned about aging up the characters. Obviously, I'm older than the actors who played the character before in previous iterations of this story.
Yeah.
Just the world of Ripley. So I knew about, you know, the Anthony Minghella film that I'd seen, and I'd seen little bits of some of the other ones too, but you know, you just want to try and forget about those, and otherwise there's no point. You know, you gotta bring your own stuff to it, or else it's pretty pointless doing it.
Absolutely, and it this does stand out and is so singular. Your Ripley and this version, I really felt the striver in Tom. You know, the class consciousness, his want to sort of enter a new station in life. How much were you sort of thinking about politics and class as opposed to, you know, love or lust in this, with this replay, do you think?
Well, yeah, I felt like he is an outsider. We see him at the beginning of the story in this version. We see him living in a boarding house in a kind of rat-filled street in the Lower East Side. We're very aware of the meagerness of his financial situation. And for me, the story is so much about somebody who hasn't been given access to the beautiful things in life, even though he's deeply talented. So, you know, we say he's a con artist, Tom, at the beginning of the story, but he's nevertheless an artist. Mm. And we see him at work and how sort of unobserved he is and how dismissed he is by society. And the only way he has to survive is by defrauding people, by turning to crime. And that's not obviously an excuse for him, but obviously, you know, you look for ways to advocate for the character. And, and then he's submerged into this society where people who have half the talent that he has are given access to all the beautiful things in the world. They could call themselves artists. They have everything at their disposal. And he, in a sort of rage, begins to emerge within him. And I suppose there is a notion of class and morality, and also about sexuality as well. I think there's a kind of murkiness to Tom's sexuality as well. And whether it's envy or whether it's lust or whether it's love or whether it's obsession or, but something about the dickiness of Dickie gets him, obsessed in some way, and he wants what he has. And, you know, I think, certainly I asked all those questions about the character and how much we should label him in relation to where he might come from or what exact age he might be or what his exact sexuality might be or what his exact pathology might be. But all those questions to me sometimes were more interesting than the answers, rather than like reducing with a very, very specific answer. Because I think what's fascinating and enduring about this character is that he's sort of like water. We can't, you know, there's a fluidity to him that we can't quite put our finger on. For that reason, he holds a sort of power over us.
Oh, I really love that. And I love what you just said, the dickiness of Dickie is really, that's such a wonderful way to put it. Yeah, that sort of quality. And I love that you've said before, specifically Tom Ripley's sexuality, that, you know, it is sort of hard to place and it's hard to trace. And your performance, it's so well calculated, it's so calibrated that sometimes you do seem to have, you know, these emotional feelings for him. And then you murder him and you roll your eyes as you push him off. One of my favorite little moments. It's so great. Where do you think...
The inconvenience of a corpse.
Yeah, it does seem very inconvenient. Where do you think he falls, Tom falls in terms of his relationship to Dickie?
I think Dickie is the one character that I think you see his affection for him. Mm-hmm. The strength of that affection, I'm not quite sure about. I like the fact that he seems to play a little bit with the murkiness of the time and the law of the time. You know, he infers that there might be a same-sex relationship going on to the police in order to cover up his own wrongdoing. So he's certainly aware of the kind of coded nature, the way people talked about sexuality back in the 60s. And so he definitely uses the secrecy that people had to conduct their lives with to his own advantage. And there's something, if that character is, and I feel comfortable calling him a queer character because I think he's certainly other, if not othered.
Yeah.
And he's queer in that sense, and in that sense that we can't quite label him. And I feel like the only hint we get, perhaps, that he has a beating heart and everything is in relation to his feelings towards Dickie. Mm. So again, it's not for me to sort of give the exact answers, but it's certainly for me to provoke that question in the audience.
Yeah, back to what you said about the inconvenience of a corpse. I mean, the two murder scenes, specifically the one on the boat, are so intense. And I have to imagine filming them must have been just absolutely wild. I mean, the process and the steps that had to go into, pulling that off. Can you talk, I guess, specifically first about the Dickie murder on the boat? What that was like, how did you do that? Because it was just, it's so complicated.
Yeah, it's incredibly complicated and time consuming. And we talked a lot about it's easy to murder someone, but disposing of the body is pretty difficult. And I think it's very important that we see this very intelligent character think. You know, we really see him think, and not just think in an expert way, but also to see him make mistakes and to work things out. I think that's very interesting. We were not aided at all by his score in that scenario. Yeah. We're just have this sort of deadly silence of the surroundings. A lot of that stuff was just sheer physical effort to try and get back up on a boat.
Really?
It's a difficult thing to do when you're coming out of deep water, you know, and when you're exhausted and you're all that kind of stuff. And so is lifting rocks to try and, bury a boat. And so all of that stuff, you know, we did it. We certainly did a lot of coverage and all that kind of stuff. So, it's just exhaustion, and that's how you work it out and how, what exactly might happen, what the logistics of lighting something on fire might be, and when you would be really exhausted, and when you're thinking with your heart and when you're thinking with your head. And there's something about the emotionality of what he's just done that I don't think comes into play until later on in the episode. So I think he's just thinking practically. He's fighting for his life. And then, like us all, when we go through trauma, that trauma kind of returns to him later on.
Mm. One of my favorite things, because I'm always fascinated by accents, is how quickly he sort of masters Italian. You know, at the beginning, he really doesn't know it. And then, you know, by episode three, he's basically fluent. And I have to know, I mean, you're an Irish actor. You're an Irish actor who's playing American, who then has to speak Italian in an American accent and learn it. How was that? How did you do that? Because I was so impressed by that.
Thank you. That was really difficult, actually. You just have to put in the work. I just put in the work. I started learning Italian 3 or 4 months before we started filming, and
really
continued throughout filming. I wanted to be able to have an understanding. I didn't know any Italian before. It's such a beautiful language. I had a really great Italian teacher and a couple on set too, which was really brilliant. And yeah, you want to be able to. The problem is that he would be good at speaking Italian. You know, you just want to get that right, and you also want to speak Italian the way Tom might speak Italian, but then also you have to speak Italian the way Dickie might Italian. So it is an Irishman pretending to be an American, pretending to be another American speaking Italian. So it gets pretty complicated.
Yeah, did that ever get confusing? Like even
you just got to map it all out. I was very lucky to have all. Sometimes as an actor, you don't get. You know, on episodic television, which I haven't done a huge amount of, but I believe that a lot of the time you only get like the first 3 episodes. So you're not really able to map out your character from start to finish. Whereas this, I was very lucky that Steve sent the scripts from 1 to 8. So I knew what I needed to do and when. And so that's very, very helpful. Can't be underestimated how helpful that is.
Another favorite moment for me that I was really, truly on pins and needles. I was like, there's no way he's going to get away with it, was when Ripley basically does Tom Ripley drag, you know. You know,
exactly.
At the end with, you know, the beard and the wig. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, that scene, just because it is such a pivotal moment and it is still so serious and kind of absurd if you sort of just explain it like,
exactly.
He's doing Ripley drag, but then it really works.
What's sort of interesting about the whole Ripley story, and, you know, we're dealing on, you know, it's a period piece in the sense that Tom's way of imitating other people in 2024 would be so vastly different. And, you know, there's so much more surveillance and all that kind of stuff. So, the question of what's plausible and what's not plausible, you know, is a big one. So a lot of the time we talked about like how much you could get away, how little you could get away with, and how you play with whoever you're talking to, what their intelligence level might be or what their observation skills might be. And so we experimented a little bit with, you know, the idea that he wouldn't recognize him at all with very little disguise. But I think ultimately you have to have something that otherwise that I think the inspector would just be like, but having said that, there are an awful lot of times where, you know, people whose job it is to look at 2 different forms of passport and ID. I mean, anyone who's tried to get into a bar using a fake ID when they're a teenager will tell you that it depends on the bouncer. You know, you go like, that bouncer is not noticing. Yay! Not that I'm advocating. I'm no, shrinking.
Absolutely. But I've been there.
My own personal experience.
Exactly.
So So, you know, it just depends on who you get. And a lot of it isn't really down to necessarily Tom's expertise or lack of expertise, but the observational skills of the observer.
I got to say, I talked to Dakota Fanning last week about filming in Italy and working with you and Johnny and just sort of how wonderful that was and how busy you were as you were in basically every scene and how, you know, just what a workhorse you were. And the amazing moments you had, you know, when you got to, you know, hang out and get a drink with the cast and whatnot. What was it like? How did you balance sort of like carrying the show on your shoulders and also working with Dakota and Johnny and all these wonderful actors in Italy, which I have to imagine was pretty nice.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so delighted anytime Dakota and Johnny were because it wasn't as often as I would have liked, because, you know, it's such a solitary character. And so, both of them are such fun people. I love the fact that this relationship between Marge and Tom in this iteration is really, really developed. You know, they really do have quite a lot of screen time together, particularly as the story progresses. But, you know, we shot it during the pandemic and I was on, you know, pretty much every day of a shoot that, you know, cover to cover took nearly a year.
Wow.
So I was very concerned that it's almost an impossible task of trying not to, you know, get COVID, and because, you know, that's what was the problem for so many of our, you know, all shoots across the world at the time. So there was a limit to socializing for loads of reasons. One, because I was working a lot, and two, because, you know, you just have to just rein it in a little bit. But, you know, it was beautiful. We, having said that, we saw a particular side to Italy that I don't think, and looking back on it now, of course, it would have been wonderful to be able to go out and go to bars and restaurants and all that kind of way. But actually, I saw Italy at a very particular time when it was really empty, and its emptiness has a certain beauty to it. I remember walking through San Marco Square in Venice in January when the Biennale is usually on, and it was just in the morning and the fog was there, and I was just completely me. There was literally nobody else.
Wow.
At a time when it usually would be packed with people. And it was, you know, it's a privilege to, because the beauty of Italy just remains completely untouched.
Yeah. Wow, that's got to be really kind of beautiful and spooky as well, just to have the whole city as a playground. I really loved the Caravaggio of subplot and whatnot. And it does feel like by the end of the series, you can sort of argue that murder is in its own way kind of an art. I mean, what Ripley does is kind of an art, kind of akin to Caravaggio. I mean, did you find a corollary or a parallel between the two?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Caravaggio is somebody I've always loved. My mother was an art teacher, and she taught me about Caravaggio really, really young in chiaroscuro, which is how he approached light and darkness. And that's absolutely what this show is about the light and darkness of people. And I love the fact that he becomes kind of obsessed with the painting of Caravaggio for no apparent reason. He feels a sort of kinship with him. And then we find out, you know, about Caravaggio's nature himself. And so the darkness, or I suppose it's the separation between what the beauty of what someone can achieve and the personality as well, and separating the artist from the art, which is what we, you know, we talk about an awful lot. We talk about a lot now that people who do atrocious things can be capable of incredibly compassionate and humane kind of art, you know? There's definitely a mirror on that front. And also in relation to him disguising himself, he becomes, in the same way he becomes a little bit like Dickie, he's able to sort of, as he is, moves away from Dickie and Marge and that sort of playboy world into a more artistic world, he sort of becomes a little bit more Caravaggio-like as he explores his own artistic side. So it's a very clever relationship that Steve has conjured up, because it's beautifully visual and also makes sense on a sort of emotional level too.
It's something that I never thought of, you know, in all of, you know, my interactions with Highsmith and Ripley before, which is just interesting.
I think she was very, you know, she was very interested in the dark side of humanity. You know, she really was.
The series ends with, you know, Ripley, you know, he's gotten away with it. It's open-ended enough that we could potentially revisit this character. And there's a lot, you know, there's more Highsmith to cover and whatnot. Would you want to relive or step back into the shoes of Tom Ripley?
It's an interesting one. I don't know. It feels like the world that she occupies is certainly a dark one. And, the ideology that of the character is a hard one to be with.
Mm.
And so I suppose because it's been such a long gestation period, I'm just very happy that it's out and letting the people's reactions to it sort of sink in.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to answer that question, but it would be certainly something that I would consider.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment it takes a huge amount of empathy to kind of look after and advocate for a character like that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like having somebody that you're trying to understand that doesn't make it easy for you to understand. and so that makes the effort a little heavier.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess we'll just let it go out there and I'll just take a little break and then see where I'm at.
I think you absolutely deserve that. You deserve a little break. And it's so interesting that you say, embodying this world. As, a fan of your work, like I first was introduced to you as a hot priest, just like the most lovable, likable character in the world.
Yeah.
But you've played a lot of sort of darker, on Sherlock, you sort of broke out in these sort of evil... or more complicated, let's say, not to judge a character, but more complicated characters. What was it like to sort of, to step back into that mode, after playing, in All the Strangers, you were so much passion for you, Fleabag as well. Yeah, what was it like to sort of go back to this mode?
Well, I think you sort of have to approach it in a way, in kind of the same way that everybody else is absolutely free to diagnose Tom Ripley in whatever way they see fit. But I can't go into it going, I'm playing a sociopath or I'm playing a monster, or I'm playing someone evil, or I'm even playing a villain. You have to just go, well, maybe why would he be doing this? And, well, that's what he did. We all can empathize with feeling angry with somebody. This character takes his anger, out through an oar or an ashtray.
Yeah.
But a lot of those kind of, murderous type scenes actually didn't take up a huge amount of filming time, comparatively speaking. Most of the stuff was him checking into hotels or pretty domestic scenes or three of them in a cafe so you're able to sort of see the human being. And, he is the protagonist. He's not the antagonist.
Mm.
And so our job is to try and see the world through Tom Ripley's eyes. And so for that reason, I certainly found it challenging. I definitely did. To be in a sort of emotional space and to occupy that kind of world for so long.
Mm.
But with anything, I finished Ripley and I almost immediately went on to do All of Us Strangers.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Because Ripley was delayed and I had signed on to do All of Us Strangers, I ended up having maybe 2 weeks between the wrap of Ripley and the start of All of Us Strangers. And that was actually a very, very cathartic thing to do because I was in London. It was the summer. It was a sort of love story. It was about the expression of love and falling in love and grief. It was a character that was probably a lot nearer myself and then a lot more, heartful than the Highsmith world. So I was glad to sort of do that. It made me feel... a little more human.
A little more human.
Well, tired. Equally as tired.
Have to imagine.
Exhausted,
but more human. Oh my gosh. Well, Andrew, I got to say, I cannot thank you enough for dropping by the podcast. And you do such wonderful work and everything, but I really loved Ripley and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Still watching, we'll be right back. When we return, more on Ripley and what other films we think could use a reboot as a series.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
So I think we would all agree that as huge fans of the 99 Magella film, that this Ripley does not tar the legacy. This filmed version of Ripley does not tar the legacy of the 99 one. It is just in a different dialogue with the original text in an interesting way. And so I feel like they both can happily coexist in the canon, which I think is very rare that you can say
that. Yeah, that is true.
So I was kind of wondering, like, to myself, and now I'm asking you, like, is there anything else, maybe from that era, more recently, or even older, where you're like, you know what, actually, if it was the right person doing it and the right sort of format, maybe this thing I love, you know, based on something, you know, great, could actually stand for another adaptation. I found myself, because of the Minghella, thinking, and I know that some people don't like this movie, but like, I was like, if it was done by exactly the right people, I would watch an English Patient miniseries.
An English Patient.
Oh, right. Interesting.
Because that has such sweep and scope. Yeah, and I'm sure there's stuff in the book that couldn't make it into the film, even as long as that film is. It's beautiful locations that would probably be green screen. Actually, wait, am I talking myself out of this? I don't know.
But that was a really good germ of an idea. I do think that would make a lot of sense. I could see the scope. And I could
Like a big cinematic, like expensive show.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, unfold over several Sundays and you'd, you know, sort of like, I don't know. I think that could be kind of fun. And that might be a little bit easier because people like that movie, but it's not as cherished as the Ripley movie is. But also for Minghella, I'd watch a Cold Mountain miniseries because I don't know that that movie gets that book exactly right.
Yeah, there's a lot that's stuffed into that movie, too. Yeah, it sort of doesn't all hold together in my recollection of seeing it, that it could deserve it, you know, the elongated treatment.
Is that like a doorstop of a book that they just
I think it's pretty long because it's kind of the Odyssey.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of places to stop. And then there's also the narrative back home with Nicole Kidman and Renee Zellweger. And the movie is beautiful to look at because Minghella's movies were. But I don't know, maybe there's just like in seven episode format, you just get the richer text delivered.
My brain immediately went kind of in an opposite direction. But I was like, okay, a movie from like around the same time that like I love, that I know a lot of people love, that could, I mean, if, again, this is
done
with the right people, with the right, in the right way, the first thing that came to my mind was Fight Club. Like a long, like a, it's from 1999.
Or Fight Club.
I know, it's very dudes rock. It's very.
But it's all women time.
Yeah, but there's some, if they are,
oh
I mean,
my God.
To take a more feminine approach, I think, I loved that book too. Like
You're a Chuck Palahniuk
I'm a Chuck Palahniuk boy. For my college application, they said, what's your favorite movie? I said Fight Club.
Well, okay, so if in your new version of Fight Club, running under the screen like a news crawl would be, the author of the book is gay. The author of the book is gay.
remember
a lot of bros don't know that.
They don't know that.
That is kind of a satire
It's sort of like a Matrix kind of thing where this is actually an allegory that you are not understanding.
You're not understanding. You're only getting the surface level. And I think if we had more time and space and the right people took it on and that was sort of infused more, maybe more explicitly, maybe not, it could be kind of interesting. And I love the, you know, just the psycho split personalities. I think it could be interesting. I think it could be good.
I would welcome that because it would also almost assuredly force me off of film and TV Twitter forever. Because,
the discourse would be so maddening.
If the 2016 all-female Ghostbusters is any indication, like an all-female Fight Club might actually destroy X for good.
Would that be a bad thing?
No, that would be a public service.
So it's like they're doing something for culture. It's like, okay, so look, your show is going to be torn apart, but it's going to serve a good
end of humanity.
Like Kaylee Reese's Tyler Durden.
That would be so interesting. That would be so cool.
All right, I'm pitching it.
Yeah.
I'm calling up our friend Issa Lopez. I don't have, my answer is slightly different. Thinking about 1999 movies, my favorite of that era movie that I will like argue is a kind of a perfect movie is Election. I don't think that anybody should remake Election because the original is so good. But Tom Perata did write a sequel called Tracy Flick Can't Win, and they are making, you know, a film version brewing, and Reese Witherspoon is supposed to return and play 25 years older Tracy Flick, and like I am so excited about that prospect.
That is exciting.
That is really exciting.
That is exciting.
I'm a Mrs. Fletcher stan. Remember that show?
Well, Tom Perata's books have been good series and good films.
And
that's interesting.
It's true. The Leftovers. Game. Like he's Little Children. He's got a really good track record.
Really good track record.
Yeah.
I'm excited. That would actually. That's a very good answer.
Yeah, because like that movie, even more so than the book, I think, with, you know, the no offense to Tom Perrotta, like credit to Alexander Payne, like I think that the movie just really captures a certain dynamic that we see play out over and over again in the real world.
Do you have any emotional attachment to Tracy Flick?
Not that I was perhaps overlooked in an election once for a boy who didn't do anything until he decided to run.
It seems like you have to write this. You got to write the screenplay. It seems like you're...
No, yeah. Yeah, call me Alexander. But yes, this is a project that I'm watching closely and super excited
about. All right. Well, that's one that's actually happening, which is exciting. Chris and I are just coming up with weird pipe dreams. But if anyone's listening and wants to do,
we'll take a general
Fight Club or English Patient.
You know who to call.
Yeah.
That does it for this episode of Still Watching. We'll be back next week to talk about FX's feud, Capote vs. the Swans. This has already aired, but we were too deep in True Detective to give it the attention it deserves, and it really does deserve it. It's a fabulous show. If you haven't watched any yet, you should. So you can spend your time doing that, or if you want to, you can find us on social media. I'm at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me at Christress.
You can find me at Hillabuster with two R's.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We were engineered by James Yost and mixed by Jake Loomis. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday. Looking forward to seeing you then.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Oh. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
From PRX.